As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. What's up, everyone? How are you? Danny, how are you?
Chilling, man, as per usual. How about yourself?
I can't really complain. You know, I'm really coming to this realization more and more every single day. I've always have been at this realization that I despise internet culture.
Okay. What kind of internet culture? There's a lot of them.
So, for example, Tulsi Gabbard had a post today,
okay,
and it was like something to do with, you know, the holy week of tomorrow's Good Friday. We're mm-hmm. recording this on a Thursday. Mm-hmm. So she said something about, you know, something about Jesus. You have a bunch of people just attacking this lady.
I thought she was Hindu.
That was one of the first responses I saw. I was like, I thought you were a Hindu.
I was just curious.
She is Hindu, or she mm-hmm. practices Hinduism. Mm-hmm. Her father was a devout Catholic, though. So she grew up in a Catholic household. Her mom was Hindu.
I see. Okay.
She ended up converting to Hinduism when she was like 17 or 18, or I think she may have been older. But when she was younger, she was a very devout Catholic. And that's where she actually gets her heat from, not supporting gay marriage when she was younger, mm-hmm. from when she was part of these like kind of these more so Catholic groups.
I see.
But she said something about that, and then you just have a bunch of condescending people like, fuck you, Tulsi Gabbard, fuck you, religion is the most divisive thing on earth, it's the reason for all war. Mm-hmm. Like militant atheists to just like, oh, Jesus wouldn't like Assad. And I'm just like, man, this is the most toxic place I think any brain can be on, is to be surfing these websites. But the reason why I bring up Tulsi Gabbard is because I had met Tulsi Gabbard once. It wasn't like a meeting like, hello, this is Henry Zamota. I met her at a Tulsi meeting. So it was more of like, anyone can meet Tulsi Gabbard
like
today.
Like a meet and greet, right.
As long as you mm-hmm. wait in line. However, I got like the chance to speak to her for like maybe about 3 minutes, which I thought was nice. And there were all these people who were bringing her the book War is a Racket. She was signing autographs of the book War is a Racket by Smedley Butler, mm-hmm. which I encourage everyone to read Smedley Butler, because he was definitely ahead of his time as far as the type of shit that he wrote in the 1930s. And one of my favorite quotes from Smedley Butler, it's a little passage from his book, War is a Racket. And this will give you a good synopsis of like the tone of how this is written. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service. And during that period, I spent most of my time as a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer and a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico, especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen of Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1902 to 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Honduras right for the American fruit companies in 1903. In China, in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents.
Humble brag much?
Well, the whole book is a just about his experience as a high-level officer in the U.S. Army, mm-hmm. and how basically what he was doing, he was just a mercenary for corporate interests who were lobbying politicians to pursue foreign policy that they wanted. And there was nothing that he did that was an actual national interest.
Yeah, that
is the thesis of the book that was written. I believe in it was written before World War II. I forget the exact year it was written, but prior to World War II. So within that context. So this guy was dealing with a lot of like South American type intra period for American colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, a lot of people trace the origins of U.S. imperialism to the foreign policy after World War I. And I actually think that's probably not the correct assumption. I think that the imperial nature of the United States goes back much further back. It goes back much further than World War I. Would you agree with that, or?
Absolutely, yeah.
From everything, I mean, from the Philippines, from our colonies in the Philippines to the Marshall Plan, I mean, to the Monroe Doctrine, to the escapades in South America.
I mean, arguably, when the United States wasn't a full, like, coast-to-coast country, you could argue that, you know, things like the Louisiana Purchase or even, you know, the acquisition of California were kind of part and parcel with the same exact idea, right? Like, they scooped up California with the ideas of, like, doing more trade with Asia, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And scooping up California or annexing it in the Mexican-American War actually kind of leads to what we're going to be speaking about
yeah.
today.
Yeah, it's a good segue.
Mm-hmm. So last couple episodes, we've been talking about the rise of the nation state of Japan. And we're going to deviate a little bit from that theme, but still talking about Japan. But we're going to, you know, we got up to the part of the story where basically Japan starts to modernize.
Mm-hmm.
And Japan's entrance to modernity was in large a reaction to Western threats. They modernized because they were afraid of being invaded by other countries.
Correct.
Because meanwhile, in 1853, when they finally gave in to U.S. pressure for to trade or to open up their borders, at that same time period, everyone around them was just being colonized.
Right. And I think, like, maybe we should talk a little bit about China actually first before we talk about Japan. I promise it'll be relevant to Japan, but I think looking at China is a really good example for this. So you might remember we talked about this very, very briefly in a prior episode about the Opium Wars, but in the 17th and 19th centuries, China had developed pretty advanced civilization, I think. And at the time, it really didn't need to import a whole lot of items at all. As a matter of fact, the opposite was true. The things that they were making were in super high demand all over the world. Things like silk and tea and spices, you know, fine china.
exotic spices. Get your exotic spices from China.
Oh. Exactly. And they were on their high point, you know, like they were doing a whole lot of exporting. And the problem was that China didn't want to trade, you know, that stuff, their fine exotic spices, for any like Western junk, right? They only wanted silver. And silver was in super short supply in the West. So this caused a bit of a trade deficit that eventually, go figure, leads to a war. It really makes you think about trade deficits today in China, actually, and kind of how the mainstream media's tough stance on China as almost like a modern example of what was going on in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, with their trade deficits then. But kind of going back to the past here, so the British were kind of pissed off about this trade deficit bit, and they try to come up with an idea for how do we trade with China and get the shit that we want without forking over a bunch of silver to do it. Drugs. They straight up sold them drugs. Opium specifically, and the Chinese loved it. It made our opium epidemic look like a bad pill habit, to be honest. And so it got so bad in China, like there were so many junkies and like their economy was literally crumbling because there were so many junkies for this. And they were getting rid of all of their valuable fine China, silk tea, spices, etc. And they're literally trading it so that they could smoke it away in opium, in these opium dens. So the Qing emperor basically tried to ban opium trading altogether because he knew that this was a problem. And the British were totally not having it. So they sent over a bunch of battleships to make sure that the opium continued to flow into China. Right? So they forced them to buy drugs from the British. And one day, the Qing dynasty, the Qing government, they do something drastic. They destroy a shit ton of opium to basically curb their, drug problem. And this led to the first opium war, yada, yada, yada. Next thing you know, the British now own Hong Kong, right? So in a roundabout way, that's what happened. Now, why did I tell this story about China? Well, Japan took notice of what happened to China. And it gave them the spooks about something like that happening to them in the future. But it also gave them some ideas about being the big dog in Asia, seeing as how China was utterly humiliated by the Western powers. And they also decided to spank China in the Sino-Japanese War, like, really shortly afterwards. But at the same time, the shogunate at home in Japan and the feudal system generally, it was pretty much collapsing. And the emperor was basically a puppet to the shogun. We talked a lot about this in the last episode that we chatted about, where we reviewed the warring states period, the Sengoku Jidai, where basically these shoguns were pulling the strings on the emperor. And a lot of people were worried at this time about fighting with Western powers. Like, it was one thing to spank China, but like, what are we going to do about everybody else? Everybody else had all these modern weapons. And at the time, the Japanese government had totally been cut off from trading with the West because they wanted, this is during the Tokugawa period when they were just like, hey, it's just all about us. We're going to close off to the rest of the world. We're doing art now. We're doing peacetime shit. They couldn't exactly build up to a Western strength without trading with the West. And so this is where we can come back to that original prime example of a gunboat diplomacy, really. But I think before we talk about like the good example in Japan of gunboat diplomacy, Henry, why don't you tell us a little bit about like what was the American and Japanese relationship prior to 1853, prior to Perry coming over and wrecking shit?
I think most people start the story of U.S.-Japanese relations with Matthew Perry, with Commodore Matthew Perry in 1853, the famous story of the black ships.
Right.
So that story is that Commodore Matthew Perry went over to Japan and said, you need to open up these borders for trade with the United States or we're going to fire on your harbor. And Japan ultimately sees, how advanced the Western navies are at this point, and they can't really do anything about this.
Hey, spoiler alert, we're going to talk about that at the end.
We're going to talk about that in greater detail, but in a nutshell, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this already kind of know that basic outline of the story. However, I think what's omitted from the narrative is that the U.S. kind of had a minor relationship with Japan. I wouldn't really say a relationship with Japan. That's probably an overstatement, but there were some run-ins, I would say, You know, there were just some minor clashes, not between the governments, but just between like civilian vessels and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the first contact between Japan and the U.S. was through whaling.
Whaling.
So whale blubber was used to make oil lamps and cosmetics and like things like perfumes and, you know, shit like that. Back in the time before whale wars.
Whale wars.
Whale wars. Did those guys save any whales?
I think so. And if the folks in the show didn't save any, there's like legitimate, like, you know, people out there that do.
Save the whales.
I don't know, man. Whales are cool.
Whales are cool. I don't think you should kill whales. I'm turned off by harming any type of like noble sea creature.
Yeah. As a side note, a couple years ago, because of some of the cleanup projects that they've been doing in New York City, the East River and the Hudson Rivers were getting clean enough for humpback whales to come back in, and they had been spotted in the river.
Really? In the East River and the Hudson River?
Yep. Specifically in the East River, yeah.
Wouldn't that be a treat?
Yeah, to just like be...
Come to New York, see yourself a sperm whale.
No, not a sperm whale, but a humpback for sure.
Is a humpback smaller?
I think so, yeah.
You can see humpback you can see whales like not too far off the coast of like Rockaway Beach. There's like whale watching.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never seen a whale. I'd be interested in that.
Never seen a whale in real life ever in my entire life. I've seen a shit ton of dolphins.
Yeah, dolphins I've seen. Dolphins are cool too. But whales, man, those things are fucking massive.
Whales are big. But yeah, the first contact between the U.S. and Japan was just like through whaling activity. And, you know, there'd be run-ins of like, you know, different ships. They knew they existed. You know, the U.S. would have – there'd be U.S. whaling ships out in the Pacific Ocean. And also Japanese ships weren't supposed to go too far away from the country. Like they had actual laws in place to prohibit – their ships from sailing too far outside of like their national like ocean territory.
Mm-hmm.
There are like some prohibits on like how they built their ships to not allow them to sail the open seas. But and there would be some run-ins. Now, what happened was that in the early 19th century, the U.S. was doing a lot of trade with China. So what these merchants figured was that Japan would be a natural resupply route. So the first recorded contact between the United States and Japan was in 1791. So it goes way back. An American ship, it blew off on its way to China, it blew off course and it landed somewhere in Honshu. Like around the Osaka region. So they landed on the main island of Japan.
Right.
But I guess this guy who landed there, he got away before he was captured, and he probably would have been killed at this time. At this time period.
Right. Some samurai would just totally annihilate him.
I mean, he would have been just captured and executed.
Right.
Which was the policy at this time. The next couple of decades, they get a little bit more lenient about like murdering people as soon as they wash up on their shores. But at this time in 1791, this guy was probably like, oh, probably should leave here. He probably didn't know where the fuck he was, to be completely honest. I mean, to the Japanese at these times, like their experience were with Europeans, they kind of saw them as barbarians or as undesirable, because think about it, like merchants who are traveling from Europe to Japan, because they were dealing with from missionaries and traders from Portugal and mm-hmm. also Dutch at this time. And I mean, they look like they just got off a ship.
Right. They look so disheveled. Yeah.
Bearded. They have different diets. They probably smell.
Probably have gangrene.
I can't imagine the living conditions that must have been on a like on an 18th century vessel,
right, or crossing the ocean,
century vessel from Europe to Asia. Mm-hmm. I imagine it probably stunk like hell.
Probably sucked.
Wet. It's probably lice. It's probably just terrible. It's probably terrible. So naturally, when they showed up to Japan, the Japanese were like,
"You guys are gross.
Ew.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out of here." So, make a long story short, Tokugawa Japan, they shut off relations with all Western countries. They only allowed trade with China as well as one European country. That one European country was the Dutch, because the Dutch, one of the main reasons why they cut off trade was because of the missionaries, the Christian missionaries that were coming to Japan to start these churches,
that was a huge departure from Oda Nobunaga, who almost became a Christian. Like he was down for the JC, you know, like he was up with that.
The thing about religions is that, you know, they can new religions can conflict with social orders and governmental powers, or sometimes if they can't use those religions for their own power grab, and that can potentially be a disruption in their power, then they're going to do the natural thing and ban that religion.
Right.
Which the Tokugawa shogunate did. They effectively banned Christianity, and they murdered Christians, Japanese Christians. Like, they persecuted them, because there were Japanese churches that started, and there's a famous case where there's, you know, this church was burnt down. But that's going way off course. They chose the Dutch because the Dutch were secular, or at least they perceived them to be more secular than the Portuguese, who they were trading with prior.
Right.
Now, in the 19th century, it became very dangerous for Dutch ships to navigate through the Pacific Ocean, because they were at war with the British. This was a time during the wars with Napoleon, and the Dutch were on the side of the French. So a Dutch ship, they would get fired upon if they were sailing, you know, on a route to China or somewhere, if a British ship spotted them. And the British at this time, and for most of imperial colonial history, the British have always dominated the sea. So this kind of led a demand for, or a hole in that usual presence of Dutch traders in the ports in Nagasaki. And what ended up happening, and this is really funny, and I actually recently just learned this, American merchants used Dutch flags to covertly enter Japan and pretend that they were Dutch to trade.
Which is about that. It'd be funny. Like, how do they, like, do they just fake a Dutch accent? Like, "Oh, hello there. I am Dutch. Would you like to buy some of my things?" You know, like, what? Like, how did they get away with that?
I don't know. "Would you like to buy some split pea soup? I'm from Holland. Isn't that weird?" Faja, can you hear me?
How did they do that? Like, you know, did they have to learn Dutch? You know, because
the Japanese probably didn't understand the differences between the different white people.
Yeah, but I mean, looking at us is one thing, but like, fucking, the language is different, right? Like, I imagine when you're doing trade with the Dutch, you probably have a couple of Japanese people that speak Dutch, and you probably got a couple of Dutch people that speak Japanese, and that's how they figure out how to trade with each other, you know? But then these Americans come up with some Dutch flags. Those Americans have to speak Dutch and Japanese. Seems really tough.
I don't think that. I think they found ways to communicate with each other I don't think they necessarily had translators. There's ways to communicate using things like sign language when you're meeting someone from a foreign country. I don't think that everyone needs to have like an interpreter for the type of trading that they were doing, because the trading that they were doing was like, they weren't social gatherings or anything like that. They weren't forming social relationships. It was very regulated and very much like a system where the Dutch basically were in this man-made like wooden island, and they had to like throw shit.
Like, yeah, I know. I mean, they didn't let them get off the ship a lot of the times, but still,
yeah.
You still had to communicate, especially for like weights and measures. You know, like this meant this many tons of rice for that many guns. You know, like whatever it is that they were trading each other.
Well, I'm sure these merchants who are willing to take the risk of going to Japan and risk having their head chopped off by a samurai knew enough Dutch to get by or to pass.
Knew enough sure Dutch really to fool the Japanese.
I'm sure it wasn't very hard to fool them.
That's something interesting. I got to look into that one day.
Something else that's really interesting is that sometime in the year 1833, a Japanese boat was blown off course and somehow ended up in Washington State.
Neat.
So the surviving sailors were captured by a Maka Indian tribe, and they were slaves. But word got around to the Canadians in that area. There was a Canadian fort,
mm-hmm.
and they were interested in hearing about or seeing who these people were, and they ended up making a mission to free these people. And they ended up, I think they had a couple of different attempts, but they ended up negotiating for their freedom, these Japanese sailors. I think there was about 12 sailors from the start, and 3 survived. And these guys are, it's actually a really interesting story. These Japanese sailors who end up in America, they're kind of used as political props in a way, where they're sent to London on ambassador trips and stuff like that. But they eventually make their way, or an American merchant named Charles King eventually learns about them. And he figured that he could use these poor bastards as a pretext to travel to Japan.
I see.
And he refuses to travel there with any armed ships or any guns or any weapons, because he didn't want the Japanese to see him as, some Westerner who's trying to swing his weight around. Someone who's coming there with some type of aggressive intent, because the Japanese aren't dumb. 1833, or this is probably a little bit after, in the 1830s, this is the time of when Western armies are really starting to make that leap over the East. So I think they know well that things are getting a little bit more real out there. But when he goes there, he thinks he's going on a goodwill mission. He ends up being wrong, because when he arrives, Japanese soldiers, they fire on his ship. And sadly, these shipwreck victims, they never make it back to Japan. They remain for the rest of their life in exile. I think they end up in like Macau or something like that. It's very sad. That's a good story to dramatize.
Yeah, right. Story of Charles King.
The story of the sailors who found themselves in America.
It would be interesting if it was like a Japanese film in Japanese.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
And the English parts are in English, but none of it is subtitled so that when the Japanese people watch the film, they're getting it from the experience of the Japanese shipwreck people. And when the Americans watch the film, they're getting it from, you know, that perspective. But we can't really understand what the Japanese are going through. We can only see, right, and like assume what it is that they're talking about. I don't know. Could be pretty interesting.
Well, I'm a big fan of doing movies in their own, in the language that
they're supposed to be in.
That they're supposed to be in. That's why I enjoyed like Apocalypto so much,
right?
Because Mel Gibson went. Say what you want about Mel Gibson, the guy is committed to bringing certain parts of the historical period that he's
filming. Did he get like an Aztec translator or some shit?
Yeah, he used he got whoever speaks that language. I don't know what the process is. There's like guilds who speak these old languages.
Mm-hmm.
But where was I? So Charles King, he's not successful. And when he actually goes back, he becomes like a big advocate for, you know, for being tougher with Japan. He actually writes a book about, you know, his mission there and how it was unsuccessful, and things probably would have been different if he went well armed and if he was a bit more aggressive. Yeah. Well, as years went on, this narrative starts becoming more and more promulgated within, you know, media culture and government culture, you know, just mainstream culture. And the U.S. starts becoming more and more interested in Japan. One reason being is that there's a conversion from wood ships to coal ships. So the U.S. thought that they could use Japan as a possible fueling station because new ships required, you know, they weren't using sails. They needed some sort of energy,
right,
to generate power for them to sail the sea or go, you know, to move throughout the sea. Another reason is that before we actually learned more about Japan, there were rumors that it was very rich with natural resources.
Wrong.
Which ends up being completely false.
Yeah.
They thought that Japan was a possible area where there could be a lot of coal mines. I don't know how they get these ideas at this time period. I think what they do is that they read like really old text and they look for symbols and signs. I don't know what access someone from 1830s or 1840s the United States would mm-hmm. have as far as like Japanese literature. I'm sure it was only come from what's from China.
Yeah, so like pretty much one dude in China wrote down something in passing, mentioning something that sounded like maybe coal in Japan, and they're like, oh, must be a bunch of coal.
Yeah, Japan. I know. There must be. Someone mentioned black suit. It must be coal. I've told the story on this podcast before, but how they were doing their early like oil expeditions and how they were trying to figure out where in the Middle East probably had oil,
right,
was just going through ancient writings and old writings and looking for societies that used oil lamps to light their sky and things like that.
Right.
And that's how they eventually discovered that there was oil most likely in the area around Basra in Iraq and in southern Iran. Mm-hmm. That's how they actually launched that expedition to find oil there, is by looking through history books. And when you get there, oil at that time period, before modern machinery, it was still visible on the ground.
You see it.
When you found there.
Yeah. You just stepped in it.
You would just step in it. I mean, that's how it was in Texas back in the day. You would just find it. Like, if you ever watched the movie, it's a very good film. There Will Be Blood.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene where...
Milkshake.
That becomes my milkshake. I drink your milkshake. There's a scene, though, in the beginning when he's on that guy's ranch and he's like looking for oil. Mm-hmm. He's literally looking for oil, and he sees basically like a river of oil, like a stream of oil coming down from a rock. And he's like, oh, this place looks like there probably is oil.
It's like, duh.
So it was done by sight, just like by an anonymous tip, like there might be oil. He was able to confirm it on sight.
All right, so they're thinking maybe Japan is like a good refueling station, and maybe it has some coal in it, and you know, this is increasing the U.S.'s interest in Japan, right? And
well, also what's important to note is that this is the period where escalations with Mexico are starting. And the U.S. kind of knows it's going to probably annex California soon.
Right.
California's annexed in 1847, 1848. One of those, at the end of the Mexican-American War. Once they know that California is part of the United States, there was an understanding that commerce with Asia was going to more vibrant and open up even larger. So they knew that there was going to be this kind of demand from the merchant class. So in 1845, and this is before, you know, California was ultimately annexed, there was a resolution that was put forward through the House to open up relations with Japan. And the guy who they chose to do this was a veteran of the War of 1812, Commodore Jason Biddle.
James Biddle.
James Biddle. To lead this expedition to Japan. But he was given orders by the Navy Department. And I'm going to quote. This is what they said to him. Not in such a manner as to excite a hostile feeling or a distrust of the government of the United States. Which I just want to point out that sounds like something that we say even when we carpet bomb somebody.
We're going to liberate the people of Iraq, but not in such a manner as to excite hostile feeling or a distrust of the government of the United States.
We're going to launch the most firebomb in human history, but not in a way to have the people there distrust us. We're going to launch an unmitigated drone war on this society, but not in a way that will produce hostile feelings or distrust of the United States government.
Yeah.
These drones are to limit hostile feelings or distrust of the government of the United States.
So what did Biddle do?
Well, the U.S. was aware of how crazy Japan's isolation policy was, so they had to walk on this tightrope. So Biddle, what he does is that he sails directly to Edo,
which is present-day Tokyo.
And to make a long story short, he is rejected. But Biddle's voyage to Japan ends up being really embarrassing. And what makes it embarrassing, rather than just the expedition being a failure, was that there were some really awkward miscommunications that happened during this expedition to Japan. So the story is, according to Biddle. James Biddle. Sounds like a Harry Potter wizard.
I am James Biddle.
James Biddle, you are a Hufflepuff.
He would be a Hufflepuff.
Oh, James Biddle. He was the best seeker before Cedric Diggory. So Biddle, what this exchange that happened was that Biddle tried to jump on a Japanese ship. Apparently he didn't have permission to jump on that ship. He thought he was invited. Miscommunication. There's a samurai on board. He pushes him, and he draws a sword on him. So he gets into a bit of a tussle.
That's pretty scary. Awkward. Pretty
scary. For the commanding officer of the expedition to be kind of dominated by the rank and file. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
And Biddle, he, you know, he demanded that, you know, he be punished by, you know, the laws of Japan. He probably wasn't punished or anything like that.
Probably not, no.
Probably laughed about it. But it ends up being a failure because all of the terms that the U.S. brought were rejected by the Japanese. And to make things even more embarrassing, when Biddle leaves, his ships couldn't catch a sail. So they had to be towed out into the ocean by the Japanese ships.
That's funny.
That is pretty funny.
It's like, hey man, you got a jumper cable.
It's like getting kicked out. Like, it's like, hey man, do you have any money for a cab? Can you give me like $10 to get a cab? When Biddle returns back to the United States, I mean, his reputation takes a really big hit. The press treats him very poorly. And here's another part of the story I didn't mention. At the same time that Biddle's there, this is happening simultaneously, there are U.S. prisoners there.
Oh, POWs.
And he failed to rescue them. I don't know if he probably didn't know of their existence at the time, but there were actually U.S. prisoners there. And what happened is that in 1848, a whaling ship was shipwrecked off the coast of one of Japan's northern islands. I forget which one.
Hmm.
But these sailors end up being imprisoned in Nagasaki, where they do most, where the Dutch are located, where they're doing their trading.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. the American that finds out that there are prisoners in Japan was a guy named Captain James Glenn. And he had actually had a very strong relationship with the Dutch. I think he may have served as an ambassador to the Dutch. He had some tie, some political tie with the Dutch embassy there or whatever.
And he probably learned how to speak Dutch from them so that he can be one of those merchants that fooled the Japanese.
So they told him that the Japanese had American prisoners. And, you know, he goes to the U.S. government saying, hey, like, there's an American prisoners there. I need to go. We need to make a move to not only restore our honor because we are embarrassed in front of the rest of the world by our terms being rejected by this idiot Biddle, but we also have to rescue our guys. And James Glenn is picked to lead this expedition. And the tone of this expedition is a lot different. Biddle was told not to rock the boat. He was like, hey, you gotta make sure that you are not going to piss them off. We're here on goodwill. We're not Britain. We're not France. We're not one of these colonial powers who's trying to get all meddly in their affairs and eventually conquer them. No, we're America. We stand for freedom. So don't do anything too crazy. Now the tone is like, we're America, but where you better treat us like with some respect.
Hmm.
the core, I have the correspondent right here. So in your correspondence with the Japanese, your conduct will be conciliatory but firm. You'll be careful not to violate the laws or customs of the country or by any means prejudice the success of any Pacific policy our government may be inclined to pursue. Nevertheless, you may be placed in situations which cannot be foreseen. In all such cases, every confidence is reposed in your discretion and ability to guard the interest as well as the honor of your country. So basically saying, be respectful, but don't be a bitch. Don't embarrass us.
Right.
Don't – if they push you or if – don't whine like a little girl and say, I demand he be punished.
Right. Push him back.
Push him back. Glenn goes to Japan and he does exactly that. He kind of plays by those roles. And he doesn't make any direct threats to the Japanese, but he makes vague threats. Mm-hmm. So he lies about like the number of ships that he has and the armaments that he has and mm-hmm. things like that.
Par for the course.
You know, he's saying stuff like, you know, I'm here on behalf of the American, you know, the United States of America, and I'm here to do whatever needs to be done by any means necessary. I'm paraphrasing him. He didn't say like, I'm going to start launching cannons into your harbor. However, he was like, I'm going to do whatever it needs to take to get these people back.
Right.
And he does. He's successful. Honestly, having these American prisoners in Nagasaki was most likely a pain in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that they were kicking and screaming. Like, why? Like, well, what's the point? Why did they were probably waiting for someone to pick these guys up. Like, what's the point of even having
them? They probably thought they were Dutch.
Yeah. What's the point of even having them? So I don't necessarily buy that the aggressive tone from James Glenn, you know, was the correct thing to do or made all the difference. I think that the mission was a lot easier for James Glenn because he wasn't going on there. His diplomatic mission wasn't to open up trade relations.
It was just to get some guys back. Was
just to pick some people up. He was like an Uber. Yeah. He's like a big Uber.
Yeah.
But he's successful and he's praised and he becomes a thought leader when it comes to Japanese relations. And, you know, Biddle was kind of really dragged across the dirt by the corporate press at that time, or, you know, I don't know if you call it the corporate press, but whatever manifestation of U.S. media was in 1840s. And
the papers.
What's that?
The papers.
The papers. That Biddle there, he's a weakling. We need a guy like Glenn doing our negotiating with Japan. He's tall, strong. He's tough. But when Glenn gets back, he starts to personally lobby for the U.S. to open up relations with Japan. He kind of shits on Biddle too when he's back as well. Wow. He writes a letter to Millard Fillmore, who is the most notorious president of the United States.
Good old
the
Philly.
Most well-known president of the United States. Who is the most obscure president?
I mean, if you put it that way, I guess it's Millard Fillmore.
Like, who is the most unknown president? Like, if you
presidents that I don't know shit about,
just like anyone would know, who are just so obscure that most people have no idea who they are.
Fuck, I don't know.
I feel like Millard Fillmore is in the top five.
Yeah.
I've always known who he was because I've been interested in this subject, but I think Chester Arthur.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Chester Arthur. I can't name one thing that Chester Arthur did as president.
I couldn't tell you which number he was. I couldn't at all. But
it gets really fuzzy between the periods of like Woodrow Wilson to
I mean maybe like
to between Woodrow Wilson and Grant, it gets really fuzzy.
Yeah, I don't really know the procession there. I don't know. Maybe
I guess
Roosevelt, Tyler. But... You know, John Tyler. I don't know shit about John Tyler.
Tyler Perry.
John Tyler Perry. I don't know shit about him.
I'm making that up. Tyler Perry is an actor. There's Zachary Tyler.
But yeah.
But we digress. So he writes a letter to Millard Fillmore, the president of the United States at this time, and he basically says that Biddle's mission caused more harm than good. And what he ultimately did was he caused more contempt from the Japanese against Americans. And the press echoed the same frustration. So one of the big reasons why the press was kind of running with his story was at the same time these U.S. prisoners in Japan were coming back and they were telling their stories to the press. So all this information got out to not only the merchant community, but you know, whoever was reading the paper at that time. Mm-hmm. I don't know the exact number of people who are reading newspapers at this time. I'm sure a lot of there were just like local papers. However, the living conditions that these guys were living in were apparently really bad. Mm. They were less than desirable. So there's a lot of animosity that was created right away, that was generated from, you know, from the press. Now, these tensions, you know, with the press and the lobbying from guys like James Glenn was kind of set the foundation for what later came to be known as the Perry Expedition, where the United States was not going to take no for an answer. Like they were going to open up border. They were going to open up trade with the United States. They were going to open up trade with Japan by any means necessary. And they were absolutely willing to threaten them with violence. And this eventually leads to the first kind of clear cut example of what gunboat diplomacy is.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I can talk to you a little bit about you know the Perry expedition because I think that's like the natural next step there. You know, as you mentioned, it's also called the arrival of the black ships in Japanese. It's pretty metal, honestly. But you know his first Commodore Perry, he was put in command of the East India Squadron, which was the one in the Pacific, and he was basically tasked with a mission to go over to Japan and end their 200 plus year closed door policy. So much harder than you know our Glynn or Biddle's missions here. And he wasn't a dummy, and he actually preferred to have led the U.S. Mediterranean Squadron, where I assume it was more like yacht week all the time. I don't know. I didn't actually research that particular squadron, but
you had to deal with the Ottomans.
He didn't want to go to Japan. He didn't feel like it. He thought it was, thought it was a bad idea. But he did it, and he's smart dude.
It's a long voyage.
Yeah. Yeah, and also it's like bad, like,
It's far from Washington. It's just
sucks.
Pain in the ass to go because you gotta go to California. You gotta go
first
to California.
All the way to California. Right.
The trip takes months.
Right.
I mean, who the hell would want to go?
It must be a pain in the ass in general. But I mean, this dude was smart, right? And he did his homework, and he knew what happened to the folks before him, like Brittle and Glynn. So before he headed out, he basically demanded extra authority from the U.S. State Department to do basically whatever the fuck he wanted to, or whatever he needed to get the job done, up to and including military force, and he did get that. It took him a while for them to agree to it, but he ultimately did get the green light to go do whatever the hell you want. And basically, he rolled over to Japan with three warships, three supply ships, and three support ships, which is impressive, but not like, we're not talking like an armada or anything like that, right? and they were all blacked out and dope, and that's why they call it like the, you know, arrival of the black ships. But he also brought some bargaining chips with him too. You know, it wasn't just all guns and stuff. Well, actually, technically it was all guns, but not in the way that you're thinking. He brought some old weapons that the U.S. didn't need anymore as a way to bribe the Japanese. So they knew that, you know, Japan at this moment, you know, was having some reservations about the West, and they definitely needed or wanted, you know, Western weaponry. So they brought some of that stuff over as a way to, you know, be like, here's some stuff we can trade right now, you know?
The first gift was a train. Was a little model train.
Oh, was it? I didn't read that. That's interesting.
I'm pretty sure one of the first gifts that he gave, that Commodore Perry gave the shogunate, was a little model train. He's like, you want choo-choo, some of this stuff, right? Choo-choo, motherfucker.
Well, you know, he brought some stuff over. Like, he wanted to bring as much leverage over as possible, right? So, again, the guns were basically just hand-me-downs. We didn't need them anymore, right? But the Japanese would love him. And he also came armed to the teeth. You know, he rolled deep when he went out over to Japan to make sure that, you know, when he got there, the Japanese didn't push him around. And first, he hit the southern island kingdom of Ryukyu, which is now unified under Japan, but at the time it was its own thing. It's in the southernmost islands of Japan. And basically when he got there, he bluffed about invading them with 200 troops unless they open up trading rights with them and let them use like one of their islands for coal refueling. He basically asked them to speak to their manager and like caroned his way to a deal with them, because he knew that the empire or the kingdom of Ryukyu would send word to the Tokugawa shogunate about what was going on in their kingdom. And so basically he went over to Ryukyu because he knew it was a softer target and also was closer, and smacked them around a little bit and just lied to them and said, we're going to invade you if you don't open up, so just do it. Also tell your friends because we're coming, you know? And later, I think it was the following year, if I'm not mistaken, July 1953, he rolled up to Edo, so present-day Tokyo, and he only brought four of his ships with him. And he went out ham like right off the gate. He just started firing blanks, and he was sending a bunch of support vessels to chase around like Japanese guard ships and harass them. And he sent them, this is pretty gangster actually. He sent them a white flag, with a letter, and the letter said, like, if you don't give up, we're gonna annihilate you. He's like, here's a flag to wave. which I thought was pretty funny.
Here in the West, when we surrender, we wave
a white flag.
A white flag.
Right. Coincidentally, at the time, this was just like a really bad time for Japan, or at least for the imperial government there. The current Tokugawa shogun, because there was, I think, three or four, I forget. But this particular Tokugawa, not the original Ieyasu, I forget his name, I think it was like something else. He was sick at the time, and he ended up dying while Perry was around, and he left the shogunate to his weaker son. And his son was a pushover. And basically, the son put the demands of Commodore Perry up for a vote among the lesser daimyos, which was actually the first time that that's ever happened at that point, where, you know, they were actually looking for, like, the input of other local warlords. And eventually they all decided that it wasn't a violation of Japanese sovereignty to do a little trading with them, so they were like, all right, fine, right? But they also did decide to fortify Tokyo Bay because they were like, well, these fuckers are coming back with more weapons. We gotta, you know, build up our forces. And so Perry tells him, all right, cool, whatever, I'm going to leave. I'll be back in a year. We'll get it started. And then when he comes back with more ships and more men. I think he doubled his men, if I'm not mistaken. I forget the exact numbers, but he brought more, a lot more. There was a bit of a fight, though, between Japan and the U.S. about where they were going to do trade. I know Perry wanted to do in Edo, so Tokyo, and of course that's their capital city, so they didn't, Japanese didn't want that. They wanted them to go somewhere else, and basically do the same, like set up the same situation that they had with the Dutch, where they put them on an island somewhere and be like, hey, you don't get off your ship, just give us a shit. But Perry's not a pushover, and he was like, fuck that. And he said, if you don't give me what I want, I'm bringing 100 ships down here, and we're going to wreck you if I don't get what I want. The U.S. didn't even have 100 ships at the time, so he was totally bullshitting, you know?
This is 1853, so right. This is,
I mean,
not...
even by today's standards, 100 ships, like 100 warships, is a lot of fucking ships. That's a lot.
I know.
You know?
It's not the British. It's not the Royal Navy.
I mean, even the Royal Navy, like to send 100 ships, the Royal, even the at the height of the British peak Royal Navy, that is something. Like, that is hard to muster that many ships. It's hard. Because we're talking modern ships, right? We're not talking like, you know.
I know, there weren't that, I mean, even the bit, well, there weren't really any naval battles in World War, there was one naval battle in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they didn't have 100 ships or anything like that. Right. It was like,
we're not talking about like rowboats here, or something. You know? Like, we're talking about like steam warships. You know, they're expensive, they're big, they're hard to maintain. And also, for every warship, you need several support ships, right? I told you, you know, when Perry first came over, he had three supply ships along with his three warships, you know? So the idea of just bringing 100 ships at the time was just like this absolutely insane proposition, right? That would have been like, if somebody would have said that, be like, yeah, I'm gonna fly over 1 million jets over your you know, country if you don't do what I want right now. Like 1 million, that's a lot, you know? That's like a lot. So Perry's a bit of a G, I think. You know, his forces and his ships were definitely superior to whatever tech the Japanese had. But like, when you think about it for real, there would be no way that he would be able to keep up a naval battle for long against the Japanese on the Japanese mainland, you know? Because again, these ships need to refuel, you know, they're going to run out of weapons. There's only but so many of them. If it was a war of attrition, Perry would have been murdered eventually.
I mean, there's no way that he would have been able to, even if he was able to have a dominant presence in Edo Bay, it's not like he'd be able to invade Japan.
No, he had like, in his first expedition, he had like maybe 200 Marines. Maybe. That's not enough people.
No, of course that's not enough. And it's not like the Japanese didn't have, this is 1853.
Right.
Come on, guys. The year is 1853. It's not like they have Gatling guns. Yet. Right.
Well, they might have, but it doesn't matter, you know, because we're talking about a country with millions of people in it, with Japan, that probably had, you know, hundreds of thousands of soldiers, including badass samurai.
It feels really good to be productive, but a lot of the time it's easier said than done, especially when you need to make time to learn about productivity so you can actually, you know, be productive. But you can start your morning off right and be ready to get stuff done in just a few minutes with the Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day podcast. You'll hear advice on everything from how to build confidence to how to get the best night's sleep. New episodes drop every weekday, and each one is 5 minutes or less, so you only have to listen a little to get a lot more out of your weekdays. Listen and subscribe to Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts. That's Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts. We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. To follow trends, track financial situations, follow gains and losses, check out the Yahoo Finance podcast. Every day, we'll give you a quick overview of the latest market and financial news that you need to know. You'll be able to hear about the biggest headlines in the business world in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. It's perfect to listen to while you make another cup of coffee or work out a new budget. Check it out now. Listen to Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
And right. Japan had guns too.
Yeah, and they definitely have guns. Not as good guns, but they had them. They eventually would have been able to, like, kill Perry. Not without some cost, but...
It would have been very difficult for any country at that time to throw their colonial weight at Japan, and right. I think influence them like they did other countries, mainly because of the geography.
Right. It's hard.
Mm-hmm. I would have been very difficult to they were able to get away with that stuff in China because China was so divided.
Right.
That they were able, and they're so spread out because like all these cities are in China are like just they're hours away from each other.
Yeah.
They're very, very far apart. All their major cities.
And that's hours in today's like driving times.
Yeah. And today's driving time.
Japan's a different. It's a different animal.
It's so mountainous. I don't think that you would have had any successful like colonial mission there until technology got like way out of hand. Maybe like in the late 1800s, maybe post Civil War.
Right.
That's when you could have started having those things. When you have guns that are firing at rapid speeds and things like that.
But
and,
even then, I mean, we're talking about war of attrition here. Even then, Commodore Perry just didn't have it. But his ability to swing his dick around and like have that big dick energy about him and do that early and often, enough was basically the reason why he succeeded. He was a poker player. He was like, all right, these last two guys, you know, the first guy, you know, he was a wimp. The second guy, he waved his finger at them, but, you know, he had an easy mission, so it wasn't whatever. He was like, well, when I go and do it, I'm going to go ahead and, like, put the hammer down immediately. Like, that was his idea. And it worked.
I also think, though, at this point, Japan had been... I think they had to have known that this was inevitable.
Yeah, that it was coming.
Because they saw all their surrounding neighbors get conquered or torn apart or carved up.
Right. China lost Hong Kong.
They were well aware of the technological differences between them and many of the Western countries. And
for sure,
when a lot of technology started getting imported in there, I mean, I think they really started to realize how far they were from just like medicine and just like architecture and like things like that. Not even just military technology, just like basic living standard technology. So I think that they knew the writing was on the wall to some degree. I can't prove that. I'm speaking a little bit out of my ass right now, but I feel like they kind of knew this time was coming. And I think Perry's expedition was very good timing for that to take place because the Shogun died mm-hmm. while he was there.
Yep.
There was just like the natural – it was like kind of like the natural organic way for them to – ditch kind of, you know, dissemble their feudal state and start adopting Western systems of government and Western technology. Because, I mean, they said it themselves. I forgot who this quote was from. Is like, but if we basically what they said, and I forgot who said this. If we modernize, if we start adopting this, we'll dominate the region.
Right. Again, remember from my earlier story about how Japan, how China lost the Opium Wars and then later subsequently lost the Sino-Japanese War. Japan is on – this is both – their decision to modernize was both one out of fear for getting spanked by Western powers, but also one out of like imperial desire for domination. Right, because they thought, hey, China's out of the game. We can be big dog now.
It's time to capitalize. From there, they do.
They do, and kind of tying it back to, you know, our last episode where we were talking a lot about, I'm trying to figure out, where does Japanese nationalism come from? You know, where did that start? And we looked at the Sengoku Jidai, the Warring States period, to try and find out, like, where, you know, different examples of where Japanese, the Japanese nation state, or the idea of being Japanese, really came about. And, you know, if there's definitely a period where you can say with full confidence, this is, you know, Japanese nationalism, it's during the period after, you know, this gunboat diplomacy. It's during the Meiji Restoration. You know, at this point, you know, the Japanese people are actively, this is where we actively start seeing, there's a Japanese word for it that I should have written down there, but they actively start mentioning the idea of a Japanese nation, of a Japanese, like, nationalism. And this, as I said, comes as a result dually of, out of fear of being dominated and out of a desire to dominate. And this is when they start adopting a bunch of, you know, modernizing, when they start adopting a bunch of Western stuff. They stop looking to their Eastern, you know, allies, and, or not allies, but Eastern neighbors, and they start looking at places like, you know, France and Germany, Prussia, I should say, and the United States to a certain extent, definitely England. You know, they start getting all the weapons. They actually do get re-centralized around the emperor, but this time around, instead of having like a puppet emperor like the shogunate had, he served as a way to unify Japan under one cultural tie, right? That was an easy way to tie them back to the good old days of you know, classical Japan, where there was, like, you know, divine deities and things like that, you know? So, you know, the Commodore Perry actually, you know, he solidified Japanese nationalism. You know, if I'm tying our last two episodes together, I think he really put that in there. What do you think?
He was definitely one of the major instigators of Japanese nationalism, or of modern nationalism, and or nationalism in a modern context, right? Because Japan, previous 200 years, they were isolated from the world, not totally isolated, but pretty much for all intents and purposes, they had very limited exposure to outside societies. So most Japanese people, the average Japanese person, did not know anyone else who was different from them. I think that there already was a foundation of a national unity there already that they were able to build upon, mm-hmm, with Western political systems. So, but I think that concept of a people that you need to ultimately create a nation state was already implemented there.
That's a good point.
The seeds were already planted.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't think that they had to go through, obviously, going forward, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in probably in our next episode when we kind of wrap everything and pull everything together. However, I don't think that I think they had the foundation of, like, all right, we are Japanese people, we have the society. Then when there becomes more exposure to what the West, that's when they start more so kind of like looking for more things within their past to further unify the people there. And that's where you have, like, the mythology of Bushido coming. Right. The mythology of the Bushido Code, and then that's when you get deeper into, like, the weird race politics they start getting into,
right?
Like the Yamato race and all this stuff that ends up being, you know, pretty kind of destructive for not only their neighbors but for them as well. This is, I don't want to say it's the genesis of it, but I think it is what wakes that spirit, that imperial spirit, mm-hmm, where they are the victim of gunboat diplomacy, But then they become one of the number one
perpetrators of it. Yeah.
Perpetrators of gumbo diplomacy. And to tie this back, I guess we were planning on talking about U.S. foreign policy and modern examples of gunboat diplomacy, but listing modern examples of gunboat diplomacy is, I don't even know if it's worth it, because U.S. foreign policy is gunboat diplomacy.
Yeah,
like it's not. I can't list examples of. Like, it's just, that's what the policy is. You have to do what we say, or we'll remove your government, find a new one.
Right. And I think that quote that you started with in the beginning, you know, really hits that, you know, brings that home.
The Smedley Butler quote? Yeah. I think that everyone should read that, War is a Racket. If you like reading like old books written in like that tone, it's perfect. Like I do. I love reading like books from the 30s and like the 20s, 30s and 40s. Just because I just love hearing how – I love like reading that writing style. It's very different, but it's still – it's not like you're reading like 1700 stuff.
Yeah.
It's just very – the tone is fun to read. But it feels like it could have been written yesterday at the same time. But it is 12 p.m. right now. I'm thinking about calling this one a wrap.
Sounds like a good plan.
Because whenever I get to the point where I know I'm not going to make sense anymore, usually when I want to be like, hey, all right, going into territories where coherent sentences are not going to come out of my mouth, so might as well quit while you're ahead. That moment may have happened like a while ago. Coherent sentences. There may have not been a coherent sentence in this podcast from me, at least.
Oh no, definitely there was.
Okay, there was a couple?
Yeah, just a few.
As long as there was like more than two coherent sentences that you were able to pick up, then I feel like that's an accomplished episode.
I think that the two that I can remember are, what's going on, guys? It's Henry Zemota.
What's going on, guys? It's Henry Zemota. I fucked that one up, too, in the beginning.
Yeah.
We had to restart that. I set up. I called Danny Daniel, and he's like, you need to restart that and call me by Danny.
Well, the real reason was because you were screaming into the microphone and it clipped.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I'm a little right. You're a little right. All right, guys. Thanks for listening to another episode of Bro History. We really do just appreciate your company and you guys continuing to listen to our show. It means so much that you guys continue to listen. If you're new to the show, make sure that you rate and review the podcast. Rating and reviewing the show is the number one way to help us grow. So rate and review. We also have a Patreon. Patreon will give you access to our Slack account as well as bonus episodes. So we have had some bonus episodes on this series where we are explaining the rise of the Japanese nation state. So check that out. We have one on China's influence on Japan and another one on the Last Samurai and their historical inaccuracies and accuracies. So what they did right and what they did wrong. So join us there. And I have nothing else to say, Danny.
Nope, me neither.
All right. Catch you guys. See you next week. Oh, peace. Happy Easter as well. This is probably Sunday, so.
Happy Easter.
Peace.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.